I'm going to use the word apologetics a little more broadly than we usually use it. Most of the time we mean more formal defenses of the faith. What I'm going to use it for here is more in the issue of polemics and how you, in a sense, defend the faith, but also go after other faiths in the Reformation, because that's all part of the process of confirming and strengthening your own faith community while at the same time trying to convince people from other faith communities to come in, which I see as the essential goal of apologetics. Now, apologetics, in this broader sense, operates on a number of different levels. Where I want to start is at the level of the popular press. This is the advent of printing creates new possibilities and new opportunities for communication. As a matter of fact, Martin Luther at one point said that God invented the printing press to reform his church. And if you look at earlier reformers such as Wycliffe in the 14th century, Hus in the early 15th century, they had many of the same ideas as Luther, but their ideas never spread widely because they had no means of disseminating them. So the printing press is what Luther saw as being the critical tool for allowing him to communicate his message. The entire Reformation really gets started when his 95 theses are printed up in German, in the vernacular language, and then distributed across Germany, and then they were translated into other languages and went beyond the border. And this is what created the entire Reformation. It was the ability to disseminate the ideas. So printing is vitally important here. And what we need to remember is that printing doesn't only operate at the level of the literate. When we're talking about popular press, we are actually dealing with some things that are specifically printed for people who are not able to read. Now, there are a variety of ways that this shows up. Probably the most common is in the form of what are called broadsides. A broadside is like a poster, a folio-sized sheet of paper. On the top of it would be some sort of illustration, a cartoon, something. And then underneath it would be a text. Frequently a poem, sometimes a prose paragraph, but very often poems. And the way these would be used is they would be put up in taverns, for example, and there would always be someone in town who could read, and he'd come in, and people would probably get a general idea of what it was about just by looking at the picture, but then he'd read the verses to go with it. And these were used in a variety of different ways, both to promote the Reformation, and actually it's the Protestants who were using these primarily initially. The Protestants were unusually good at using print right from the start. Luther was a German peasant by background, and he understood how to communicate to peasants. He was actually very good at communicating to people at all different levels of education. So he had an instinctive grasp of how to do this, and so he grabbed hold of the printing press, and he aimed things at different target audiences, he and the people around him. It took the Catholics literally decades before they started catching up to Luther on this. So we're talking primarily Lutheran material here. And, well, like I said, on the top there would be a cartoon of different types. It could be anything from an image from the Book of Revelation that depicts the Pope as the Antichrist sitting on the seven hills of Rome with Martin Luther and Philip Melanchthon as the two witnesses coming up to him. You know, these images out of the Book of Revelation. Or it could be simple lampoons and mockeries of Luther's opponents. There's one rather famous one. You need to remember, Luther was a peasant. He could get pretty crude at times. And although I don't think he drew this, it's very much, I wouldn't surprise me if he came up with the idea. He had a discussion with Cardinal Cajetan, a Catholic cardinal, and he wasn't impressed with Cajetan. Cajetan was upset with Luther. And so they did a cartoon of Cajetan for one of these broadsides that, now excuse me, this is a little bit colorful. They depicted Cajetan as a pair of buttocks with a harp sticking out of it and the cardinal's hat on top, the harp forming sort of the nose for the face and then the cardinal robes under it. Like I said, it was incredibly crude, and it's especially crude when you understand, if you haven't been around harps, if you take them outside and the wind blows, the strings sound. So it was basically what this immediately communicates is that Cajetan's statements were the equivalent of flatulence. And like I said, it can be incredibly crude. But when you are dealing with propaganda, and when you're dealing with trying to capture popular opinion, these kinds of things work. It's a matter of lampooning opponents, it's a matter of mocking opponents, it's a matter of presenting your own guys as the heroes. All of these kinds of things are being done as a sort of popular level apologetic to draw people into Lutheranism and away from the Catholic side. There are other things that are being done within the popular press as well, which we'll get to as we go along. But I just wanted to highlight this notion of the use of cartoons and images as a way to convey theological ideas, as a way to promote one side and, frankly, to try to undermine the other by making them look ridiculous. These things are fairly easy to find online, and it is remarkable the range of things that you find on these broadsides. Along with those, you have various things known as ephemera. These are generally fairly brief leaflets, tracts, short tracts, things like that that were widely printed. The advantage of these is that they're very quick. Once you have them written, just something brief, doesn't have to be very long, you can print them up in quantity very, very quickly. And even if it's only dealing with something that's relevant for the next week, it doesn't matter because you haven't spent a lot of time or effort doing it. So there's a lot of ephemera that comes out, things like this. Again, most of these things that are printed sooner or later revolve around religious disputes. In the 16th century, religion was the dominant topic for publication, for printing. There isn't even a close second. If you look, for example, at Elizabethan England into the 17th century, if you look at Elizabethan England, there are a dozen Puritan divines, Puritan pastors, whose writings would single-handedly outsell the total output of all of the writers and all the other literature of the English Renaissance. Like I said, there are a dozen of them. Each of them single-handedly could do this. So whenever we're dealing with printing in this period, almost inevitably we're dealing with religious issues, whether it's at the level of ephemera or these larger types of work that we'll get to in a moment. Now, in addition to that kind of sort of popular work, the Protestants needed to convince, really frankly, the movers and shakers in society, the people who are running the cities, the people who are running the governments, they have to convince them to leave Catholicism and join the Protestant side. And this was frequently a very difficult sell, because the Catholic Church was certainly well established, it was powerful, there were important and powerful people who supported the Catholic Church, such as the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, the King of France, any number of people that you can point to. So it's not necessarily a good move politically to change religion. And the only way you're going to get people to do that generally is if you can convince them you are right, or I suppose in some cases, if you can provide them with a political advantage by going to the other side. That happens occasionally. But most often what's going to happen is that cities are going to convert because of religious argumentation, not because of politics. What will happen here is within Protestantism, the training of pastors was really focused on education. They were trained to be expert theologians. They were trained exceedingly well at this. They were taught Catholic theology, they were taught Catholic canon law, and they were taught Protestant theology as well. And they knew all of the arguments and all the weaknesses of the Catholic side. Every one of them, every pastor that was fully trained, went through all of this and learned all of this. So what will end up happening, now in contrast, remember, I don't know how many of you were here at the beginning of the series, but one of the biggest problems facing the Catholic Church going into the era of the Reformation was that the clergy was typically uneducated. Many of them didn't even understand the Latin of the Mass that they chanted every day. They just learned it by rote. So they have no theological training. They have very little training, if any, in canon law. Some of them have a bit more, but none of them are particularly well trained, with very, very rare exceptions. So what will happen is that a group of Protestant pastors will come to a city and they will challenge the local clergy to a debate. And even if the bishop is going to participate, which he typically didn't, the bishops themselves weren't that well trained. They weren't that well educated theologically. So what would happen is the pastors would come in, they challenge them to a debate, they'd sit down in front of the whole town, they'd be holding this debate, and they would, the Protestants would say, okay, you go first, it's, you know, this is your home, we'll let you make the first statement. And the priest would stand up and start making a statement, and he'd get part of the way through, and the Protestants would interrupt him and say, excuse me, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but you didn't get that right. According to canon law, this is what it says. Or according to the church council, this is the way it works. You're kind of close, but it's really this. Okay, now this is automatically going to get the priest flat-footed. He was not prepared for this. And they'd keep interrupting and doing this all the way through. And then when the priest was finished, they would stand up and dismantle everything that the priest had said. Not only that the priest had said, but also the canons and church council decisions and interpretations and so on that the priest had used. You know, both what he said and what the originals say. This is how well trained these guys were. And at the end of this, these debates, which would last for hours and hours and hours, at the end of it, the town council would almost universally would vote to convert to Protestantism, because the debate was, they were so effective at the debate that they would convince the town council that they really needed to switch. And again, city after city after city converts to the Reformation. The entire city will convert via this process. Now, the thing that we need to note about this is that the pastors who are doing this are exceedingly well trained. They are trained in all the arguments. They know exactly what their opponents are going to say. They know all of the opponents' arguments, and they know how to counter every one of them. And actually, as I said, they're better trained than the priests are. What this means then in practice is that the first lesson I would draw from this is that if we are going to be engaging in discussions or debates with people outside of the faith, it's very, very important that we know what we're doing. We need to know their arguments as well or better than they do. And we've got to be ready to counter them. And we also, of course, have to be strong on our own and be able to defend our positions. Now, it's also worth noting that in the long run, this is going to reverse. What will happen is after, in the 1540s, the Jesuits will be created. The Jesuits were always very, very highly educated. And by the time you're moving toward the end of the 16th century, some of the standards for pastoral education had slipped a bit. In the early days, they were very aggressive and very, you know, very much interested in equipping people thoroughly to deal with Catholics. That's the early challenge. As time goes on, other things begin to become more important, and the Jesuits now are the better trained. So they will come in and they will challenge the Protestant pastors to debates, and the Protestant pastors can't quite stand up to the Jesuits. They're better than the earlier Catholic priests had been. But again, they are frequently no match for the Jesuits. We have lots of letters of these pastors in these small towns writing to Geneva or writing to other major centers saying, "Look, send us somebody. We're going to be overwhelmed here. We're not ready for this." And unfortunately, the Protestant cities didn't have people to send frequently. So the net result is one of the results of the Counter-Reformation, one of the successes of the Counter-Reformation, is going to be retaking territory via exactly the same techniques that the Protestants had used in the first place to get it. So again, there's a caution in there that as we have already let our training for pastors, theological training for pastors, slip, we're not going into formal debates, but people are still coming in with questions. And there are a lot of things that are floating around on the internet, a lot of arguments and so on. And if we don't know what they are, if we don't know how to respond to them, we're not going to be able to effectively deal with the kind of questions and challenges that come in. I've done exactly one debate with an atheist, David Silverman, president of the American Atheists. And he, you know, I did my presentation first, then he did his presentation, and he did it on something I had never heard of. And so I was stuck in that situation. I had some general knowledge, but I didn't have the specifics that I really needed at hand. I could respond to some of it, but not all of it. I have since spent a lot of time learning about that particular blind spot that I had. But if I had been better prepared, if I'd have known the kind of arguments that were floating around, I'd have been in much better shape for that particular debate. In any event, moving on, there are also more formal theological, in addition to these kinds of debates, in addition to the popular literature, the ephemera, and the broadsides and such, there are also more formal theological disputations, as they're called. And these will be typically done between theologians on both sides. So both sides are very, very well trained at this. And these disputations are designed, well, both, it's a full-scale debate. Both sides are coming in equipped and ready to win. What will happen in the course of these disputations, there are a couple of ways that they can occur. Some of them can be live debates. Others can simply be a theological tract or treatise attacking an opponent. So, for example, there was a Catholic theologian named Pigius who attacked Calvin, wrote a treatise against Calvin because he objected to Calvin's view of predestination. Calvin responded to Pigius with his own treatise. And this combination of Pigius' treatise and Calvin's is one of the great statements about, that goes right with the bondage of the will, the freedom of the will and the bondage of the will with Erasmus and Luther. It's one of the great statements in this this process of working out the issue of predestination versus free will. These are both important documents. Most people give the win to Calvin on that one, just in terms of the strength of his argument. But the point is that you get these formal theological statements that are written to attack, and then responses, and sometimes you have counter responses. It can go back and forth. And each of these steps is a full-scale treatise. And these are referred to frequently as disputations. Disputation technically would be the debate, but this back and forth interaction of theological treatises also qualifies as a disputation. And these are actually quite common in the period. While in some ways the most important work in practical terms is the work that's being done on the ground, work that's done to advance Protestantism or to counterattack and try to take territory back Catholic on a popular level, there is a lot of high-level theological discussion going on too. And the Protestants and Catholics are both busy trying to, number one, defend their own positions, but also to find the weaknesses in the other positions to attack those. It's not much different from the kind of thing that apologists do today. The one that I find perhaps most disturbing in the midst of all of this is what are called intramural debates here. Protestantism is built around the premise that all theological answers have to be derived from Scripture, that Scripture becomes your final authority for answering theological questions. And there's an intrinsic flaw in that, because I accept that it's true, but the question that comes up is what happens if two people have different interpretations of the same passage of Scripture. How do you resolve it? In the Catholic Church, you have the magisterium, the teaching authority of the Church, that can resolve those kinds of issues. What do you do among Protestants if you differ? Well, in most cases, you can simply agree to disagree. But in some cases, as we'll see, actually, in the last of this series, which won't be done until tomorrow, the debates within Protestantism sometimes involve things that they considered central to the faith. And under those circumstances, without someone to appeal to, the only option is to split. So the net result is Protestantism begins fragmenting very quickly, typically over the sacraments. Luther, Calvin, most of the major reformers argued that there were two essential marks of the Church. The Church is where the gospel is rightly preached and where the sacraments are rightly administered. They all agreed on the gospel rightly preached. They were all preaching essentially the same thing, but they differed on the sacraments. And since the sacraments were an essential mark of the Church, they split over their interpretation of the sacraments. And it's a rather unfortunate tendency of Protestantism to fragment that way. So what ends up happening frequently is that you will get different Protestant groups attacking each other in these sort of intramural debates, that where each side is trying to defend their view of the Eucharist or how much water you use in baptism or whatever. And these can get very heated. And sometimes, frequently what will end up happening is a disagreement about one area will frequently become a disagreement about others. They will start looking for other points that they disagree with in the theology. And you're going to end up getting a serious conflict about a lot of other issues get sucked into it. But again, the goal in these kinds of things, we're dealing more with debate than apologetics here, but debates are actually a form of apologetic. What you try to do in apologetics is to shore up your own faith, shore up the faith of your side, while at the same time trying to undermine other people's belief systems to convert them to your side. And what we see happening in these debates is precisely that. Your side in these intramural debates being my version of Protestantism as opposed to your version of Protestantism, or it can be more generally the Protestant side versus the Catholic side. I didn't have time to finish theology in the vernacular. Suffice it to say that Calvin begins to do that. He begins to write formal theological treatises in the vernacular, which again become very important for propagating, defending, and spreading his particular version of theology, especially in France. So the question is, why were the Jesuits created? Was it mainly as a response to Protestantism, or was it something else? This is touching on a very, very basic historiographic question concerning Catholicism in this period. Traditionally, the reform programs in Catholicism in the period were referred to as the Counter-Reformation. Catholic historians object to that terminology because they say, look, there were different reform programs in the Catholic Church prior to the Reformation, like Erasmus's. So what we really should talk about is Catholic Reformation, not Counter-Reformation, because we're not just countering what the Protestants are doing. Having said that, there is certainly a counter-Reformation thrust within the Catholic Reformation. So the question is whether the Jesuits are Catholic Reformation or specifically counter-Reformation. Jesuit historians will generally describe them, I think, as part of the Catholic Reform. However, considering that they were founded in the early 1540s, right in the middle of a lot of the serious battles over Protestantism, and given the way they were almost immediately put to use by the papacy, I think it's safe to argue that they were primarily a counter-Reformation thrust, but with a lot of other uses as well. The Jesuits were a unique religious order in that they took the same three monastic vows everybody else did, poverty, chastity, and obedience, but they also took a special vow to the papacy, to be loyal and obey the papacy under any circumstances. What this means is that the papacy could assign the Jesuits any kind of job, and they are very early on, they are working to figure out ways of undermining Protestantism. They'll do things like start high-quality colleges and make them free so that to encourage Protestant kids to send their Protestant parents to send their kids to Jesuit schools, because the Jesuits figured if they got them early, they'd have them forever. You know, so there's a lot of things, and they're involved in these debates and a number of things like that. So there's a lot of counter-Reformation work they're doing. I think that that's really a major inspiration for them. Having said that, they are also heavily involved in missions work. There are Jesuits in North America and the Great Lakes. There are Jesuits in Japan. There are Jesuits in China, in the Philippines. So they're also very highly active on the mission field. So you can't see them exclusively as counter-Reformation, but there is, I think, a strong component of that in it. And I think it was really one of the main inspirations why the papacy decided to allow them to go forward. Why did the Jesuits succeed, particularly in Southern and Central Europe? I think that there are a couple of factors that are involved there, and I'm going to argue that it's less the Jesuits themselves as the combination of the Jesuits and the Habsburgs. Because the Habsburgs, of course, are very hardcore Catholics. Charles V was something of a progressive Catholic. He wanted to see some reforms in, but there was no way he was going to break with Rome. Philip II, his successor, very conservative Catholic. Number of the others, in Central Europe, it gets a little more complicated. Some of them are more open to reform, some less. But overall, they tend to be very, very tightly connected to the Catholic Church. And I think that the combination of the work of the Jesuits in their very effective work, combined with the political clout of the Habsburgs, helped the Counter-Reformation succeed as well as it did in Central Europe and Southern Europe. Well, Central Europe especially. Southern Europe, you're dealing with situations like Italy, where Protestantism never really got a strong foothold anyway. It's too close to the papal territories. Spain, the Spanish monarchy, again, is just very stridently Catholic, and Protestantism doesn't really get a strong foothold there either. So in those areas, the Jesuits are certainly active, but they weren't going to be Protestant in any event. It's the Central European states, Southern Germany, and so on, where the Jesuits, I think, have their greatest successes, and I've got to link that to the combination of the Jesuits with the Habsburgs. So the question is, the Jesuits have historically been known for being important innovators theologically, important in terms of development of Catholic theology in some new and innovative ways. Were they that way from the very beginning, or is something else involved there? I think that the reason for that is primarily the nature of the Jesuit order. In order to become a full Jesuit, you effectively have to get a PhD. You know, an SJ after someone's name, Society of Jesus, an SJ after someone's name indicates that that person has essentially completed a PhD. So they're very, very highly educated. They are also, in their schools, they always set them up to take advantage of the most advanced and progressive educational opportunities that are there, new methodologies, things like that. Jesuit schools were working with humanism and the new learning, as it was called in the period, right from the start. They brought in the most cutting-edge stuff that they could into their schools. So they've got this very progressive, if you will, concept of how to teach, what they should be doing in education. They are highly educated themselves. I think that kind of environment creates a kind of creativity in terms of how you approach theology that is going to help move them into some of these more innovative areas. Now, not all of them are positive. Molinism, for example, has got some really interesting theological concepts, but there's a part of Molinism from Molina, a Spanish Jesuit. There's part of Molinism that, actually, I don't remember whether Molina was a Jesuit or whether his thinking was adopted by the Jesuits. But anyway, there's part of it that has got some really negative sides to it, too. A lot of people today like to talk about the philosophical side. Bill Craig likes Molinism as a philosophical system. But there's another part of it where, for example, Molina will argue that if a, quote, serious doctor of the church has said something is legitimate, it is probably legitimate. It becomes what he called a probable opinion. If you have people who contradict each other, one person says, yes, this is appropriate, and another says, no, it is not appropriate, and they are both serious doctors, both positions are probable. And what that means that as a Jesuit acting as a confessor for, say, a king, the Jesuit can encourage the king to do whatever he wants to do, pretty much, on the basis of these kinds of probable opinions. And as a result, Jesuits frequently will become confessors to kings so that they can direct policy. And they are kept in their position as confessors because Molinism is flexible enough to let the king do whatever he wants to do and tell him it's legitimate. I mean, so there are a number of things like that that come up that, you know, we can talk about some positive sides, but there's some negatives as well. This is why the Jesuits were known as being really slippery, frankly.